From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. The First Amendment protects the public's right to criticize the government and public officials. As a matter of fact, every public meeting in Nevada must include a public comment period. But starting last year, multiple Washoe County residents say a board member of their local library board has started harassing them for expressing their views. Bert Johnson with our sister station KUNR brings us this story.
In April of last year, Justine Overacker got a surprising voicemail.
Hey, good afternoon, Justine. Hi, Gianna Jax. I'm just trying to reach out to you to follow up to multiple emails. I had a couple phone numbers. I left a message earlier at a place.
The message from Library Board Trustee Gianna Jax sounds friendly, but this wasn't a social call. By that point, Jax had been hounding Overacker for almost a month over public comments she'd made about the controversial trustee.
I also was going to just try to send you a letter. If you could reach out to me, I appreciate your time. Gianna Jax.
Overacker's complaints stem from a KUNR investigation that found Jax had an undisclosed financial relationship with Nichelle Hull. Hull's a conservative activist who wanted the library to limit access to books with LGBTQ themes and authors.
I read that article, I got a little steamed, and I decided to write public comment.
But Overacker says she didn't reach out to Jax directly and never shared her email or phone number.
It's kind of scary that she has that information.
Jax went on to contact Overacker 9 times. It started with emails, around 1 a week. Next came phone calls. Then, just over a week after the voicemail, Overacker got a letter from Jax at her home address. Overacker says she didn't respond because she'd never wanted to speak with Jax in the first place.
She wasn't asking me to meet or for clarification. She was just demanding a retraction and an apology.
Jax didn't respond to questions about why she kept contacting Overacker. But UNR political science professor Brad Johnson says he's never heard of a case like this before.
This is a little odd, this situation, especially for a board that is appointed like this.
He says library trustees operate in a gray area. They're appointed by county commissioners. But the only way they can be removed is if they miss 3 meetings in a row.
It's created an insulated space where this type of concern doesn't necessarily have a recourse.
But Overacker isn't the only one who says she's been harassed by Jax. At the library board's January meeting, William Puchert spoke about his experiences during public comment.
I personally was harassed at a local store and at my job by one trustee, and have heard allegations that this trustee has inappropriately contacted others.
Puchert's been calling Jax out for her connections to library antagonists like Hull for years.
Most troubling, I would say, was she acted as a defense attorney to those who disrupted Drag Queen Story Hour.
Washoe County canceled the popular children's events in 2024 after a librarian was hurt by a protester. Puchert says at around the same time Jax was trying to reach Overacker, she approached him in person.
I was working down in Carson City at the legislature, and she, as I walked around the hall, she confronted me and started to harass me.
Puchert says he made a beeline for the nearest elevator, but the harassment didn't end there. Jax confronted him one more time in Reno while he was out having lunch. Overacker, on the other hand, didn't hear from Jax for a few months after she got the trustee's letter. But last fall, Jax started emailing her again. This time, Overacker wrote back, telling Jax to stop. She never got a reply.
If anything, I feel more strongly about my original comments because she's acting in a way that is unbecoming of a public official, in my opinion.
Library Board Chair Ann Silver didn't directly respond to emailed questions about Jack's behavior. She says she doesn't criticize her fellow trustees. And public records seem to bear that out. A year ago, after KUNR's initial story came out, Jax emailed Silver a rebuttal to the investigation. Moments later, Silver replied. She wrote in part, quote, "Glad it was basically ignored at the last board meeting. Support from this end." Bert Johnson, KUNR News.
Here with me now to dive deeper into this story is KUNR's Bert Johnson. Bert, welcome.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
A lot to unpack here. First, let's back up and talk about the library board itself. When did you start covering the library board?
I first got into this subject in 2024. You know, there had been a little bit of coverage about this trustee, Gianna Jacks, prior to that. Specifically, the Reno News and Review did a big profile about her because when she was appointed to the library board, a bunch of conservative activists in town were celebrating this, including a field operative for Turning Point USA who was positioned up here at the time. That's notable because this is supposed to be a nonpartisan position. It's a volunteer board. They're just supposed to advocate for the library and its staff and its policies. But when I started digging into it, I found that she was privately identifying as a Republican. I found a recording of a meeting where she spoke to the Republican Women of Reno, which is a conservative political club up here. And not only that, she was advocating against a ballot measure that would have renewed some dedicated library funding, which was about to be on the ballot that year in 2024. She was doing all this from her seat on the board, and she was actually chair of the board for a while. And then, you know, the election didn't go the way that library supporters wanted it to.
Right.
This ballot measure was defeated. A little bit after that, I realized that there were a series of publicly visible Venmo payments bearing Gianna Jacks, the trustee's first name, connecting her to Nichelle Hull, which came up in that story.
So who's Nichelle Hull and what is her relationship to Wake Up Washoe County?
Yeah, that's a great question. So just to back up again, just to set a little bit of the stage here. Conservative activists started showing up at library board meetings in late 2022 at the same time that people were doing that nationally in Moms for Liberty chapters around the country. In Washoe County, we don't have one of those, though. So Wake Up Washoe County was sort of filling the role of Moms for Liberty in terms of organizing conservative activists to show up at library board meetings. Nichelle Hull was in charge of that.
So what does Gianna Jacks say in her defense? You know, does she say she's harassing, you know, does she admit that she's harassing folks or, you know, has she defended herself at all in any of this?
In terms of this story, I never got a reply from her. She did have her lawyer email me back when I requested comment, but they didn't say anything substantive. They basically just acknowledged that they had gotten the request for comment. So I don't know.
What are you hearing from other library board members? Are they concerned at all?
Aside from board chair Ann Silver, I haven't reached out to any of them, and I haven't seen any chatter online. No one's reached out to me or anything. Again, just based on the way that this kind of board is set up, there's like really no one that Jacks is accountable to institutionally speaking. Obviously, she's accountable to the residents of Washoe County.
Now, the library board hired a new library director in Washoe County just a couple weeks ago. What role will that person play when it comes to possibly reining in board members?
So technically, the library director is the only employee of the library board. They're actually subordinate to the trustees. And that has played out in a very dramatic way here in Washoe County before the previous director resigned. Right before a public meeting where everyone kind of expected the board to fire him, partially because trustee Gianna Jacks and board chair Ann Silver had been publicly complaining about him for months on end leading up to that point. There was also an evaluation process that the trustees had just gone that wasn't looking good. So anyway, that person's going to be answering to this board while also trying to represent the interests of the citizens of Washoe County and the employees of the library system.
Now, I understand who has ultimate say over the board itself. You know, the Washoe County commissioners appoint them, but that's about it. You know, do lawmakers have the ability to make changes to that board? Would it rely on a change to state law to make changes to that board? Or is that something that the county commission can do?
It would be a state change, because these boards are defined in the Nevada revised statutes.
You know, you've also been on the receiving end of some of this harassment over your reporting on the library board. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. As a result of this most recent story, for instance, There's a political candidate up in our community named Drew Rebar, who's running for Assembly District 40. He's a Republican. He's an ally of Trustee Jack's. The day after I sent my request to comment for comment to Jack's, he sent me an email saying that he was working on his own story about my story. I haven't seen anything come out of that yet, but you know, this is a person who often confronts people in public with a camera. He's come to the station here at KUNR and tried to confront me over some of my prior reporting, sort of demanding that I respond to some of his questions about my reporting process. But, you know, it's pretty transparent. This story in particular, everything I learned is in the final piece.
Per, we have about 30 seconds left. You know, this is a developing story. What are you going to be keeping your eye on?
I'm going to be looking at the reappointment process. Jax has about a year left on the board, and then it's up to the county commissioners to decide if they want her to stay.
Bert Johnson is KUNR's senior correspondent. Bert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tribal leaders from across the U.S. and Canada were in Las Vegas last week for the annual Reservation Economic Summit, or REZ. That wrapped up, and they were here to talk about all the things their communities have done to bolster their local economies. KNPR's Jimmy Romo, our Indigenous Affairs reporter, attended the conference. He joins me now. Jimmy, welcome.
Hey.
The conference brought in a record-breaking number of attendees this year. You know, what sessions did folks most gravitate towards at this conference?
Yeah, it was super busy. Session rooms were packed, all for energy independence conversations. And there were several conversations and sessions on this topic, ones where rooms were full and people were just packed in sardines along the wall for these sessions. So, and these are big topics for tribal leaders to look at, you know, is this energy independence going to actually benefit them? Because these are big benefits to tribes. This is energy sovereignty and keeping that money on reservation. But these are big projects. So it takes a lot of time for planning and funding to get these projects underway. So there's just a variety of sessions about financing and types of microgrids, just like solar farms and sometimes natural gas projects. So we even have some a plant here in near Las Vegas. It's over by the Moapa Band of Paiutes Reservation. It's on the reservation. And so we are using full-scale solar farms right on reservation. So gaining a microgrid or an energy plant, so it creates a potential for an economic driver and job creation on reservation. So it was a big deal at REZ.
You know, why are tribes wanting to move away from current energy providers?
Absolutely. So reservations or Indian country, they're located throughout the country and in different spots. So one might be within a city, a small or large, or might be hours away from a town, right? So energy connection is just it varies widely. So these tribes might be connected to an energy grid, and energy is always going up. And from what I've heard from panelists and sources is that these utility companies just do not care, or their bottom line is just make money, right? So we've heard many horror stories about energy connection where tribes are experiencing more outages. And also, you know, we had this presentation from Calusa Indian Community where they went energy independent because their utility company was just increasing prices, experiencing a lot of outages. So they moved to complete energy independence. So that's why to move away from their utility companies.
Obviously, saving money on your energy bill is something that we're all trying to do. You know, what other economic drivers did leaders talk about at the conference?
Yeah, I mean, we had so many more conventions at these convention. We talked about cannabis. There was healthcare funding and data centers, right? So cannabis has the potential of being an international market, especially in the U.S. So that's big for even Nevada tribes, right? We had we have a big operation here in Las Vegas from the Las Vegas Paiute tribe where they grow, they package, they wholesale, they sell at a dispensary and have a cannabis lounge. So there's a lot going there for Nevada tribes and cannabis. Healthcare is another one, right? Healthcare with the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, although tribes can't pull directly from that fund, that $50 billion fund, there is still potential to work with the state and keep going to get that funding to make their tribes have a hospital and keep those medical dollars on reservation, right? So, and we also had conversations about data centers that go hand in hand with energy production on reservation. So this there's like a 10-year gap for folks to keep getting money for these benefits.
Jimmy Romo covers indigenous communities for KNPR. Jimmy, thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Auto insurance rates have been rising every year for the past several years, sometimes by double-digit rates. And those increases are especially significant in Nevada, considering it's already one of the most expensive states to own a car. Nevada's auto insurance rates are up about 60% higher than the national average. Congresswoman Susie Lee recently held a roundtable discussion on the issue. She said that at the beginning of the year, over 500,000 Nevadans saw an increase in their auto insurance rates, and that another 45,000 are expected to see their rates increase later this year. Lee said the affordability crisis is real and unsustainable.
First of all, Nevada is the second most urbanized state, which leads to more opportunities for traffic collisions. We have the third highest rate of vehicle theft, the fifth highest DUI rate. And as we all know, we're a tourism spot, so individuals come in from other states and they're not necessarily familiar with our roads and laws.
There are many other factors that also affect every driver's auto insurance rates as well. The Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez dove into the issue, speaking with two subject matter experts. Here are those conversations.
Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thank you for having me and glad to be here.
So, Michael, essentially, even if everything stayed the same, if you had no tickets, lived at the same address, drove the same car, you would still experience a significant increase in your auto insurance in Southern Nevada. Is that correct?
Yes, not just in Southern Nevada, but across the nation. We've seen auto insurance costs go up substantially over the last several years. There's been several different measurements about how much, but in October 2025, the Bureau of Labor Statistics did a study, and they found that basically since February 2020, auto insurance premiums went up by 55% on average. And most of that happened from 2022 to 2024. And that's just an overall average. So in many places, actually, auto insurance costs have gone up even more.
So we know that the accident rates in a particular area have a direct impact on the overall insurance costs in that area, which is a driving force, no pun intended, for the high cost of insurance in the Southern Nevada area. But before we turn our focus to that, are there other systemic issues that you can discuss and that you think need to be essentially overhauled with the insurance industry?
Yes, there are. That's a very good question. Auto insurance companies use a whole bunch of non-driving socioeconomic factors to unfairly charge you higher premiums. And there's a lot of these factors. They include your job or occupation, where you work, your education level, whether you went to high school or graduated from high school, or whether you went to college, or whether you have a master's degree, your zip code, where you live, your homeownership status, which means whether you own or rent your home, your gender, whether you're married, and most of all, your credit scores. Auto insurance companies use your credit scores to charge some pretty big penalties. We actually did a report in 2023, looking at data from a few years ago, and we found that basically, if you're a Nevada driver with a perfect driving record and excellent credit, your average annual premium was $667, which is not bad. But if you were a driver and you had the same driving record and fair credit, your average premium went up to $990. And if you had a perfect driving record and poor credit, you paid an average premium of $1,267. That's hundreds of dollars more and about a 90% penalty just because of your credit score. And all those penalties add up. You could pay one penalty, say, because of your gender, another penalty because you only graduated from high school, a third penalty because you work as a waiter instead of like an investment banker, and a fourth penalty because you have poor credit. And all those things can easily make auto insurance really expensive or even unaffordable.
According to the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department's data, from 2017 to 2021, there were 491 speeding-related fatalities in Nevada, with 339 taking place in Clark County. In southern Nevada, we know that the three main contributors to this area's high accident rate are speeding, impairment, and distracted driving. Can you talk more about how these impact insurance rates?
Good question. They all drive up insurance costs. Speeding is obviously against the law and results in more frequent accidents. So that's one of the drivers of costs. Impairment is another one. Again, that leads to higher costs. And distracted driving often doesn't get as much attention as it should. But it also is one of the major drivers of rising insurance costs because when you're on your phone or texting or something like that, your attention is diverted. And it just leads to significantly more accidents. The accidents that happen can be significantly more serious, and it helps drive up insurance premiums. And also, insurance companies have been demanding significantly higher rates. Insurance is a pretty lucrative business. The companies make a lot of money, and they want big rate increases. And for the most part, the Nevada Division of Insurance has been pretty friendly and given those rate increases.
So excessive speed and DUIs will also stay on your driving record for a significant period of time and will affect your rates. Can you provide more detail about this?
Yeah, basically, if you're excessive speed or you have a drunk driving conviction, your insurance costs will go up by substantially large amounts. It varies from company to company and from state to state, but Liberty Mutual, for example, says that on average, your auto insurance cost will go up about 25% after a speeding ticket. And a drunk driving conviction will cause your costs to go up substantially more. Could be 50% premium hikes, could be 75%, could be even 100%. But if you then drive safely afterwards and take things such as like a defensive driving course or some sort of course that shows that you are have become a better driver and improved your driving, your insurance rates can sometimes go down.
Another contributing factor could potentially be that the whole situation has led to more litigious actions as it relates to car accidents. Is that also a contributing factor? And what part of that is the contributing factor?
We do not think so. Obviously, lawsuits can contribute in some cases to certain things or affect costs to a bit. But the insurance industry often claims that the reason for rising insurance costs is frivolous lawsuits. And we've looked at this, and other consumer advocates have looked at this area, and we just don't see any evidence for that. One of the main reasons for this is that auto insurance costs are going up, not just in places where it's that are more friendly to lawsuits against insurance companies. They're going up in states that are not friendly to these lawsuits. And in fact, auto insurance costs have been going up dramatically in states where legislators have recently passed reforms curbing these lawsuits, making it more difficult to sue your insurance company and limiting the damages that you can get. So claims that reducing frivolous lawsuits are going to reduce insurance costs, they just don't add up. This is a nationwide problem. It's a consequence of insurance company excessive rates, their use of socioeconomic factors, sometimes lax regulation, and simply trying to crack down on lawsuits isn't going to really help most people.
Is there anything that Nevada drivers can do to lower or prevent their insurance rates from increasing?
There's a bunch of stuff you can actually do. Our first and most obvious advice is to shop around, try and get like a better deal, look at different insurance companies to see if you can save money. You should also check your credit score. As we previously mentioned, insurance companies charge people higher premiums based on their credit scores. And we think this is very unfair and unjust, and we're working to get it banned. But in the meantime, if you can improve your credit, that will help lower your auto insurance premium. You can also update your driving habits. For example, if you're driving less because due to remote work, a retirement, or your new job is closer to home, let your insurance company know, because how much you drive is a key risk factor. And so if you're driving less, that could qualify you for a reduced premium. You can also take a defensive driving course. a lot of insurance companies offer discounts if you complete a defensive driving course. That's one way to save money. A whole bunch of insurance companies will give you discounts if you pay your policy all at once. However, that does require that you have the funds to pay, like, say, 6 months worth of auto insurance premium, which we understand that a lot of people do not. Finally, you should also ask your insurance company what discounts they offer and what you qualify for. You can qualify for some discounts based if you're, say, a student and you have good grades, if you have a paperless insurance policy, or if you have an anti-theft device in your car. Sometimes you can also qualify for discounts based on your job or if you've served in the armed forces.
We've been speaking with Michael DeLong with the Consumer Federation of America. I want to bring in Janet Ruiz, Director of Strategic Communication with the Insurance Information Institute, which is comprised of more than 50 insurance company members. Janet, hello, and thank you for joining us.
Hello, and thanks for having me today.
What does the insurance industry see as the top contributing factors that affect auto insurance rates?
The three that are the top for pretty much every state right now are rising medical costs, expensive repair costs, significant inflation, and increased legal litigation.
How do some non-driving factors, especially the socioeconomic factors, influence rates?
What we're seeing in Nevada specifically is high accident frequency and severity, and this is particularly in Las Vegas.
We know that there's demographic data supporting certain statistics related to age and gender, but how does where you live factor into the equation?
That's a great question. Population growth and traffic have really made a difference in particularly southern Nevada, and it's contributing to more frequent accidents.
And so who are the socioeconomic groups that you're seeing with the fastest growing rates in southern Nevada? Is it seniors or people with bad credit, or who would that be?
You know, that's not necessarily the factor in who's causing the accidents, of course. But what we will see is bad credit rates are a factor on your insurance premium.
Can you explain a little bit more about how bad credit affects your insurance rate?
Yes, it's just one factor, and it's not the main factor. The same you mentioned, gender, that's not a main factor. Those are what we call minor factors. The main factors are always your driving experience, your history, have you had accidents, tickets, etc., then where you live. So if you're living in Las Vegas, it's going to be more expensive than in a more rural area. And again, the insurance companies are regulated by the state, and so they are required to turn in the premiums, how they're rating them, all the algorithms. And if the Department of Insurance thinks that it's too much that they're trying to charge, they will not allow them to do that.
Is the proliferation of auto accident legal cases then contributing significantly or a little? And what about these cases specifically drives up the rates?
Well, what really drives up the higher premiums are attorneys and companies that really look to inflate the amount of the claims, and we call that nuclear verdicts. So what we're looking to do in Nevada, as well as all states right now, is to really balance that out, should you be able to litigate, of course. But we should stay away from the nuclear verdicts that really don't reflect the amount of loss the individual has.
And we've talked about a number of different issues and factors that weigh into the insurance rate equation. But why is Nevada considered one of, if not the most expensive state to own a car?
What we're seeing here in Nevada is the high accident frequency and severity, and that's particularly in Las Vegas. And the legal litigation is higher than some other states.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us, Janet.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've been speaking with Janet Ruiz with the Insurance Information Institute and Michael DeLong with the Consumer Federation of America.
It's hard to believe it, but just 10 years ago, there were no professional sports in Las Vegas. However, the last decade, Vegas has very much become a sports town. That was abundantly clear this month when the NBA, the last of the country's four major sports leagues to land in Las Vegas, announced plans to formally explore placing a new expansion team there. Just days later, the NFL announced Sin City will host the Super Bowl for a second time in 2029. Here to break it all down for us is veteran sports journalist Alan Snell. He's the publisher of lvsportsbiz.com. Alan, thank you for being here.
Paul, great to be here.
I want to talk about the NBA and the Super Bowl in a minute, but I think the biggest news of the week has been the firing of Golden Knights head coach Bruce Cassidy and the immediate hiring of John Tortorella. It's not often you see a team in playoff contention fire a head coach midseason. What is going on?
It was a blockbuster news item, Paul, on Sunday. Got the email, and people have to remember, Kelly McCrimmon is not shy about pulling the trigger on some of the biggest trades and coach firings. We saw this with Gerard Gallant, the popular coach in 2020, Pete DeBoer. He got the axe in 2022, and then Bruce Cassidy came on board in 2023 and led this team to a Stanley Cup title. He was very popular with the media, really traditional, old-school, defensive-minded coach. And he was into his fourth year, very successful, won a couple division championships along with the Stanley Cup championship. And, you know, that's the thing about Kelly McCrimmon. When I went to his press conference on Monday, he mentioned that the easiest thing would be not to do anything. And this is a team, and if you like hockey and you're into the Golden Knights, just know that your GM, it might not have been the most popular move, but the guy wants a win and will do anything to do it. I mean, it's a pretty ruthless, intense kind of approach. But, you know, firing a coach 8 games to go in the season, replacing him with John Tortorella, very different personality type, more of an expressive kind of guy. We'll see if it lights a fire and sparks a team.
So what should we know about Tortorella?
Very expressive, very demonstrative. He's been around the block. He's a guy who's coached in the league for 23 years. I knew him in Tampa when I worked at the Tampa Tribune. He was actually the coach of the Tampa Bay Lightning when they won the Stanley Cup in 2004. Not shy. He will take on all comers. He will take on players. He will take on media. He will take on other coaches. But he's kind of seen as a quote-unquote player's coach. And the one message that I got from his press conference after they beat Vancouver 4-2 on Monday night was that he told the players, relax, go out, play your game, and relax. So he's perceived as a player's coach.
The team is 33 wins, 26 losses, 16 losses in overtime. It's a critical point in the season. There's only a few games left. Do the Golden Knights still have a shot at the playoffs?
Yeah, they're in the position right now. They're in third place, so technically they're in the playoffs. I think they will limp toward the finish line and get into the playoffs. How far they go, that is the big question. They might play Edmonton in the first round. Edmonton has its issues as well. So the Golden Knights, I don't see this year going really deep into the playoffs, but I expect them to be in the along with 15 other teams. They will likely have probably the lowest number of points of any of the 16 teams in the playoffs.
All right, let's switch gears and talk about that other big news. It appears Las Vegas and Allegiant Stadium will host another Super Bowl in 2029. Obviously, the big game is big business for the Strip, but how important was the game to the rest of the city when it hosted in 2023 business-wise?
Well, that's a good question. It's a question that's always under the debate. Economists at universities across the country always say that the NFL and that the boosters who talk about the economic impact overestimate the numbers. Again, you heard, it seems like every big event, Paul, has like a $1 billion economic impact. F1, $1 billion. Raiders come to Vegas, $1 billion. Super Bowl 58 in 2024, $1 billion. And very little is shown about the methodology, about how these numbers are come up. Obviously, it's a big deal for the hotels on the Strip. The NFL loves it. They get whatever they want. The LVCVA will be spending at least, I think, $55 million. That was the amount they spent on the Super Bowl in 2024. And, you know, the answer to your question is that it varies based on whether you're a vendor or not. It depends on whether your business is directly providing a service for Super Bowl 29. So for the hotels, a big deal. There'll definitely be hundreds of thousands of visitors, no doubt about that. The economic impact, that varies depending on your business and to what extent you're involved in this event.
Since we're already talking about football, let's quickly go over some of the big moves the Raiders have made in this offseason, including the hiring of their own new head coach, Clint Kubiak. In February, he signed a 5-year deal with the Raiders following a coaching stint in Seattle. He replaced Antonio Pierce as the team's third coach in 3 seasons. What do we know about him?
He's part of this new generation of young offensive minds, very intense guy. He's the son of a former football quarterback and coach, and he represents a complete clean slate, Paul, for this franchise. And keep in mind that the Raiders will likely pick the number one. They're going to pick the quarterback, Fernando Mendoza, from the national championship winning Indiana squad. So this team, it's kind of interesting. They're in their sixth year. They came to Vegas to open up the Dome Stadium in 2020. They're in year 6, and they're still trying to search for an identity. And I think under this new coach and this new quarterback, you're going to have a complete new identity. They've literally had 5 permanent or interim coaches leading up to Clint. Mm-hmm. So, hey, the page has turned, and you're going to have a clean slate here.
For some folks, the biggest news might be that the NBA has begun the process of placing a new team in Las Vegas. Where are we at in that process, and when should we realistically expect to see a new team in Las Vegas?
Well, the timeline from all reports is 2028-29 season. It's going to be a huge, huge year. The A's are supposedly opening up their stadium on the Strip the same year, 2028, probably March of 2028. The NBA, the seed for the NBA coming to Vegas has been planted for quite a few years. It's not really a big surprise. And right at this point, it's just a matter of getting an arena lined up. I would suspect it's going to be T-Mobile Arena. Bill Foley, the owner of the Golden Knights, has already said he's willing to pour in $300 million into upgrading this arena. Keep in mind, Paul, this arena cost $375 million 10 years ago. The arena is celebrating and marking its 10th birthday this year. It's a big deal. And I would suspect the NBA will be at T-Mobile Arena for the 2028 season.
What about the ownership team? There was a belief at one point that NBA star LeBron James would be part of that ownership group. He's reportedly out. Who's still in?
Well, the big name is Magic Johnson. He met with the governor, Joe Lombardo. There were the photo ops. Bill Foley, keep in mind, Bill Foley, when he started the Golden Knights, he actually partnered with the Maloof brothers. So that was kind of an interesting, odd couple. Magic Irvin Johnson is, obviously a well-known, iconic name in the sport. Keep in mind, Paul, he has a lot of sports business stakes mm-hmm. all over the big-time major league sports industry. So I would suspect Foley, Magic Johnson, and as a wild card, I'll even throw in Shaquille O'Neal as a possibility to be part of that ownership group. He's mentioned his interest in the Las Vegas market. As you mentioned, LeBron most recently said he is no longer interested, even though he did for years leading up to this year express interest. But my money is on Magic Johnson combining forces with Bill Foley to have the team at T-Mobile Arena in 2028.
You know, that news comes while the NBA is gearing up for its 2026 season, which begins next month. But before that, there's an expansion draft, then the league draft. And on top of that, there's major changes to the league's collective bargaining agreement. So there's still some potential for big shakeups before the team even takes court on May 9th. You know, let's start with the expansion draft. Talk to me about that. You know, what are we keeping our eye on there?
Well, it'll be interesting. I mean, teams will be given the the goal of protecting some of their young players. So this is a big deal. We're going to see this actually, what's interesting enough, Paul, in the WNBA as well. That league is expanding. And hopefully we'll see some WNBA basketball coming up as the local Aces go for their fourth championship in 5 years. But, you know, basically it's teams who have to make some very difficult decisions protecting players. And, you know, things are different this year in Major League Sports when it comes to expansion drafts. We have a great example here in Las Vegas, the Vegas Golden Knights. They won their conference championship and went to the Stanley Cup final in year one. So teams can be competitive right out of the chute.
Are we expecting any of the top names to go from the Aces this year in that expansion draft?
Well, that's a tough question. You know, whenever you have Asia Wilson on your team, you're going to compete for a championship every season. Jackie Young is an incredible player. She's kind of the number two player, if you will, on the team. Tremendous scorer. Chelsea's been with the team. She is the point guard, as you know. Hopefully they'll be protected.
We got about 15 seconds left, Alan. A's have started their season. What are you going to be keeping your eye on there?
The young players to see it continue to develop. Their game plan, as you know, is to have these young players lead a upright, kind of a forward trajectory right into Las Vegas and their stadium 2028. So look for the development of those young players.
Alan Snell is a sports journalist and publisher of LVSportsBiz.com. Alan, thank you.
A lot of ground to cover there, Paul. Good job.
Thank you. There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Privat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
You told us last year about a gallery in the new Las Vegas Civic Center. I understand they have a new exhibit that combines art and history.
You know, there are several unique ways to learn about the Black experience in Las Vegas. For instance, you could go visit the Harrison Guest House in the historic West Side, or you could watch the movie Across the Tracks by filmmaker Emmett Gates. That's from 2024. And most recently, Carmen Beals of the Nevada Museum of Art curated the new exhibit that you just referenced, and it's called Rhythm and Resilience, Black Vegas. It tells the Black story of Las Vegas from when John Howell settled in Southern Nevada in the late 1870s, and it goes all the way to the 1980s. It addresses segregation and the development of the historic West Side, and all the ways that Black life and culture helped shape Las Vegas.
And how does this exhibit tell that story?
Visually, Beals curated a ton of items, from paintings and other works of art to artifacts and some displays. And there's also an audio component with narration provided by Las Vegas historian and co-founder of the Las Vegas Black Historical Society, Clay T. White. Just remember, it's only open between 10 to 3 on Mondays through Thursdays, and the exhibit is open until August 20th.
Sounds like a pretty great way to spend an afternoon. Mike, I'm feeling like a play this weekend. Got something to recommend?
This is the final weekend of Passage, the final main stage production this season by A Public Fit, which, by the way, is working with UNLV's Nevada Conservatory Theater for this particular show. This 2019 story by Christopher Chen is referred to as a fantasia, and as such, it's, you know, a little vague. It does center around a teacher and a doctor in a colonized country, and it is inspired by E.M. Forster's A Passage to India.
Colonization seems to be the topic du jour for many nowadays. Does it also get political?
Not in the explicit sense, but in the sociopolitical and thematic senses. It's more about power and how that affects people's relationships. Things get personal, but as you well know, Paul, the personal is political. So Passage explores the systemic oppression and struggles and the consequences of those things that saying suggests. And so you can witness it for yourself through April 5th at the UNLV Black Box Theater.
I'm sold. Easter weekend is upon us as well. Anything families can do to celebrate?
Do you remember how we told people to get on a boat with Santa last winter?
Let me guess, you can raft the Colorado with the Easter Bunny?
It doesn't look like that specifically, but we do get to go looking for his eggs on the Colorado, and that's courtesy of Hoover Dam Raft Adventures, which is calling this the world's longest floating egg hunt. At every mile of this trip, you'll be asked to find an egg, a very big, likely pastel, likely not inconspicuous, and likely not naturally occurring egg, and that's your Easter egg hunt. Now, each rider also gets an Easter swag bag and a barbecue lunch afterwards. Note that this takes place on Friday, April 3rd, so that should leave your usual Easter tradition unconflicted.
I am so ready for the Easter candy discounts. That's all the time we have for this week. Mike, thank you.
Thanks, Paul.